welcome. Before we proceed, any apologies?
Morning, co-chairperson, co-chairpersons, members and guests. We receive apologies from the Director General of National Treasury, the Minister and Deputy Minister of Finance, and the Integrated Nation. Thank you.
We note those apologies. Team National Treasury, I think today is just relaxed. We are in a workshop stroke training mode. So more than anything else, I want to hear what you are doing, right? So that you can arm us that when you come back, what type of questions you should ask. So tell us that even have questions that we don't want to ask. we expect from us as members. But thank you very much for coming. We'll be together with members of SCOPA until around about 11, and then they've got the program that they must attend to, and then we'll move to another venue with National Treasury to continue. So we're with National Treasury the whole day. Yeah, we'll see if we must leave here at 5. But at 11, we'll break. I don't know any comments from my colleagues. Thank you so much. Let's be in your hands. More interactive. If you can take us at least up to 10 minutes so that we can have an hour. If we have to interact, if you can finish earlier than that, so much the better. But definitely at 10, we would like to start asking questions and then to allow you to interact with us. Thank you so much.
Ticket and stuff all by once again conveying the apologies conveying the apologies of the DG, the DM and the Minister. Unfortunately they were called away to the urgent cabinet meeting this morning. I'd like to start off by introducing the team that we brought. We selected this team specifically for those areas that we thought would be important for us to engage on today. And Chair, I promise we won't go light. We take your work very seriously to hold Treasury's feet to the flame. And in that way, we ensure that we gain the confidence of citizens that National Treasury's processes are fair, transparent, are applied in a way that moves the transformation and development of the country forward. My name is Laura Musemi. I'm the acting head of the Office of the DG, as well as Chief Director for Strategic Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation. Part of our delegation is also Ms. Silindile Kubeka, who's the Acting Accountant General, Mr. Willie Matabula, who's the Acting Chief Procurement Officer, and Edgar Sishi, who's also in the DG's office but provides support to the Office of the Deputy Minister. As has been requested, the methodology that
just
we've applied.
Can I interrupt just on that concern about too many acting? Mm-hmm. And I know some people have been acting for us, and we need to find out.
Thank you very much for that, Chair. So the methodology that we've applied is that we've provided detail in the presentation against which we will touch on that information and then leave time for interaction, given that I'm sure you've gone through the presentation that we've provided. The first slide is a summary slide of the context that I will be providing against which the work that the OCPO and the OAG do most of draw their mandate from. National Treasury is established in terms of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, and we draw our mandate from Chapter 13 of the Constitution, which in particular establishes the Treasury and gives us the mandate. mandate to enforce compliance with measures established and to stop the transfer of funds to an organ of state if that organ of state commits a serious or persistent material breach of the measures. In addition, it sets out in the Constitution our mandate in regard to procurement. Procurement matters will be more fully detailed by Willie in his presentation. And furthermore, the Constitution deals with clauses that refer to government guarantees, which is an important part of the work that National Treasury does, as well as remuneration of persons holding public office. Furthermore, Treasury's functions and powers are set out and detailed in the Public Finance Management Act, and in particular, we refer to Chapter 2. Here, Treasury is given the responsibility and is set out in terms of promoting the national government's fiscal policy framework, as well as coordination of the macroeconomic policy. In particular, the committee will know Treasury is responsible to coordinate intergovernmental finance and fiscal relations, and very importantly, manage the budget preparation process, as well as exercise control over the implementation of the national budget, including adjustments to the budget. We also facilitate the implementation of the Division of the Revenue Act, and we monitor the implementation of provincial budgets. We also ensure promote and enforce transparency and effective management in respect of revenue expenditure, assets and liabilities departments, public entities, and constitutional institutions. Furthermore, this chapter also provides us with Clause 7, which talks to banking, cash management, and investment framework. As you know, National Treasury invests on behalf of a national government. Annual consolidated financial statement is the responsibility of National Treasury, as well as providing this committee and others with financial statistics and aggregations. Equally, Treasury is responsible for a number of delegations, as well as the National Revenue Fund. We've also provided the committee with the vision and mission of National Treasury. As you know, National Treasury, along with all other departments, is in the process of drafting a new strategy for the next five-year cycle. But our vision will stay the same as it's drawn directly from our mandate, as well as our reference to our mission. National Treasury directly reports into six of the current outcomes, as well as directly will be participating in all seven of the new priorities. National Treasury, as I'm sure you know, having engaged with our APP, National Treasury has 10 programs, although two of those programs are transfers only. Program 9 is a transfer to SARS, and Program 10 is a transfer to the intelligence cluster. Program 1 is our administrative program, and in that program we have the strategic objectives, or now the outcomes, for the Ministry, the Office of the DG, as well as corporate services. Program 2 talks to the work that Treasury does in the area of economic policy, as well as tax and financial sector policy. Program 3 is an important program, equally for this committee. It includes our outcomes on public finance, the budget office, and intergovernmental relations. Program 4 talks to assets and liabilities management, which also talks to our oversight over SOCs, is located in that program. Program 5, which is of particular importance to the work that we're doing this morning with the committee, and is the program that the two DDGs report into that are here, which is the Office of the Accountant General and the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, is in Program 5 of National Treasury. Program 6 talks to the international work that we do and increasing South Africa's voice in financial, international financial institutions in Program 6. Program 7 is our civil and military pensions contributions to funds and other benefits, and that program is delivered for us by JEPA. Program 8 talks to the technical support and development finance, which is mainly work that is done through the project office of GTAC. We have provided for the committee, and if the committee is wanting to ask particular questions, we provided the purpose for each of these programs, so it gives you a sense of what these programs do. And if there are any questions on that, we'll ask. We'll answer them, sorry. This provides the context of the department. And that context then provides the grounds on which the OAG and the OCPO, which is the key area of our work this morning, is located. So at this point, I'll hand over to Silindile, who will take you through those areas of work that you particularly wanted us to emphasize that falls within the Office of the Accountant General.
Before you proceed, Ms. Kubeka, we are joined by the chairperson of Honorable Sonia. Welcome, Standing Committee on the Auditor General. And I'm sure that there are also members of from that committee. So you have got a full bench between you and the three committees listening to this meeting. Please proceed.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks, Honourable Members. As has been said, I'm the Acting Accountant General, and in starting with slide 11, where it outlines what Program 5 does in terms of the Office of the Accountant General, that is facilitation of governance and accountability, transparent economic and effective management of revenue, assets, as well as expenditure. So basically what we do, which is then the structure of the Office of the Accountant General, is encompassed on slide number 12, where we're basically dealing with the model. To take you through the model, basically there are two sides to it. The one, obviously, that is from a legislation, that comes from the legislation, and the other one that comes from the implementation side. In between is the people that are accountable for it. On the left-hand side, Chair, if I were to start, everything that we do, obviously, will start with the strategic plans, the outcomes that are part of the MTSF, as well as, obviously, looking at the policies and priorities of government in terms of service delivery. And how that is monitored will be on the right-hand side, which is performance requirements. So at the start of including the APP as well, that's where it is. The Office of the Accountant General, in that case, will be responsible from a strategic planning point of view on, obviously, the outcomes and ensuring also the effective and efficient public sector in terms of the prescripts that we issue and the monitoring that we provide to departments. There's also the service delivery programs that are there, as I've mentioned. Also, the output will be in terms of the budget, and how all those are monitored will be through the various spheres of government, including departments as well as entities, in terms of the executive authority, their responsibility in the process, as well as the accounting officers, who are the key role players in linking the executive authorities as well as the departments through this process. Also from a delegation, the Office of the Accountant General will be mainly be responsible for financial delegations in terms of the treasury regulations as well as the DSMA, as well as, obviously, I'll still touch on it as we proceed, in terms of the role from a condonation, as well as where required certain exemptions due to impracticality of some of the issues that the departments will be faced with at that point in time. My colleague Laura also mentioned that we, as Treasury, responsible for consolidated financial statements. That will obviously happen at the Office of the Accountant General, where once the financial statements, as most of you may be aware, are being completed and the Auditor General has audited, the process of consolidating those begins, and those will be tabled later in the year, in ensuring that as the public sector we have a consolidated set as required by legislation and report timely. Again, there's a review process in whatever that happens, and obviously monitoring through either the internal audit and risk management processes, which obviously will then feed into the oversight committee, where the audit committees as well as the different portfolio committees, through their oversight, exercising oversight, will then be ensuring that the department account for the responsibilities that they've been tasked with. Moving into the next slide, it's basically just the governance framework that encompasses what I've said. Externally, obviously, overall, if we can call it at a macro level, will be the PFMA, which obviously most of us, if not all of us, would be aware of. Also, taking into the learnings of the King for the principles, most importantly, the Batupile principles, which obviously are also highlighted, as well as the Public Service Code of Conduct. External to the process will also be the oversight committees, as well as assurance providers in the process. The Auditor General as a Chapter 9 institution, as you may be well aware, is also part of the key strategic functions that the government has in ensuring that we, in that enforcement of the, in the Office of the Accountant General, there is obviously that monitoring and ensuring that the analysis that is provided and audits that are provided, obviously the funds have been spent in accordance with the required mandate. The audit committees will also be quite linked to the internal audit function on any department, and they provide an oversight. The internal auditor, must emphasize, plays quite a critical role in the process, because they play an independent process between the department as well as the oversight. Even though, obviously, in certain instances, you may find that there are challenges, but it's quite key that internal audit is independent of the processes, so that it provides credibility of the processes. And they are also a material link with the Auditor General, as some of the processes, the Auditor General, due to obviously the limitations of the audit processes and the guidelines that they work under, may not be able to look at every transaction. That is where the internal audits, they may be able to rely on the work of the internal audit. I'm emphasizing this point simply because, Chair, that it's quite critical that the internal audit unit, as well as the internal auditors, the chief audit executive, as well as the head of the audit committee, are credible people that will ensure also that independence and that oversight is adequately implemented in departments. Failure to that will obviously result in certain oversight functions not being properly executed. Moving into the next slide quickly, some of the things that I've already touched on in terms of who are the key stakeholders in the financial management process. As you will see, the key function for the Office of the Accountant General is to ensure the effective, efficient, and transparent system through obviously ensuring that the institutions are well equipped. All the functions that are here are coming from the PFMA, and obviously they are responsible officials that are tasked with those responsibilities. Again, you will see that the Chief Financial Officer plays quite a critical role in the execution of this mandate. We work with CFOs quite a lot. We have CFO forums. There is one coming up on the 3rd of September. We work with them in ensuring that they are aware of their responsibilities. As it may have been seen, for example, on the previous audit outcomes that have been issued by the Auditor General, a regression in municipalities especially, and again, the Treasury has embarked on several processes in enhancing those controls. So one of the challenges that the AG has highlighted is inadequate skills that have been seen in some of the entities, especially at the CFO level. Also, as you see, in terms of the responsibilities from an audit committee perspective, they play quite a critical role, and it over arcs in terms of if you're looking at the CFO, the head of risk, and the internal audit, because that's where they will provide oversight and blind spots that the departments and entities and other spheres of government may have missed. So it's quite critical, again, that the skills that entities get is actually adequate. People of integrity, and obviously ensuring that all the requirements are properly executed as required by the mandate and the legislation. The next slide focuses on the critical issues in terms of, at the end of the day, when everything else has been done or supposed to have been done the way it has been done, that's the different sections of the PFMA as well as the Treasury regulations that guide us through the process. I must just emphasize and note the error. It should be Section 38(1)(b)(1)(c), not B. in terms of when you're looking at the responsibilities of accounting officers in ensuring that they must put measures and processes in place that unauthorized, irregular, fraudulent, and wasteful expenditure are obviously reported, are prevented in an entity. And that links to Section 45, where, as you can imagine, there are big departments that, obviously, as an accounting officer, you may not have sight of each and every transaction that happens in the department. Hence, every official that is appointed in the government is must abide by Section 45, where they, as officials, need to make sure in whatever they do, that they do things in a way that will prevent and ensure that the departments do not incur fruitless and wasteful, unauthorized, and irregular expenditure. So going through that in high level, obviously it's the relevant piece of legislation that prescribes the unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless expenditure, and obviously the functions and the responsibilities that happen in terms of the reporting of that once it has been discovered or suspected. It's not only when there is indeed an actual fruitless or irregular expenditure that has existed, even if or when there is a suspicion that it may occur, legislation requires that it's reported, and it is reported in terms of Section 38(1)(g). Also, in terms of the disciplinary action, this is where, I am not sure that the chairs and the honourable members, if they've had an opportunity of engaging with the Auditor General, and I would obviously assume that if it hasn't happened, it will happen, as you may be aware of the amendments of the PAA. That's where the major challenges lie with that process, because in most years, year in, year out, Auditor General has a cry that they will not put.
The acronyms, remember, you spoke about it, PPA, PAA, okay. So just as we go along, 2-3 months, then you can start using it now. Okay.
Apologies, Chair, noted. The Public Audit Act. That is the act. I would not obviously go in detail with it because the Auditor General will go through it. I just wanted to emphasize the link in terms of the consequence management that is not happening, and especially in terms of SCOPA, because that is how most departments end up coming to SCOPA, simply because they are not implementing the requirements of this section. It requires, once there has been irregular or fraudulent or any wrongdoing that has been picked up, there must be consequence management. And the Auditor General was therefore saying, in ensuring that you do, have they will be going through a process that they will explain, obviously, through the amendment of the Public Audit Act, that will then require them to issue a debt certificate where accounting officers have not really, over a period, implemented Section 38 in terms of the consequence management and taken disciplinary action. That is when they will obviously issue and require that the public funds are paid back. Moving forward, Chair, is also just on the same slide in terms of Section 40, which is quite critical from a reporting perspective, ensuring that the accounting officers must ensure that they've reported even everything that has happened in terms of these irregularities, as well as ensuring that obviously it's well disclosed both in their financial statements as well as mentioned when they consolidate in their accounting, in their annual report. Section 45 is the responsibility of officials, which I've already discussed. So the rest of the presentation is basically outlining the unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful, which obviously is the main reason the officials come and departments come and present in most of the portfolio committees, especially accounting to the committee, SCOPA committee. It's basically outlining at what level and what each one is. This lecture is just highlighting in terms of the definitions on each and every one. On unauthorized, there is usually an ambiguity, and through the discussions with the Auditor General, to say it will happen if there is, maybe let's just say in terms of the economic classification of a line item in the financial statement, and they would say that is exceeded and it will be unauthorized. It must be emphasized that it happens at a main budget level or at a vote level that it will be unauthorized. We encourage, wherever possible, which should be basically all the time, that there is no unauthorized expenditure and the department do their utmost best to make sure that when they can foresee, because if you have a fully functioning finance function, they would foresee upfront that they may have an unauthorized expenditure. They then consult the relevant treasury. In this case, it will be the public finance, and follow the relevant sections of the Public Finance Management Act that will ensure that they get the authorization to exceed on their budget. But if they have not done that, that will result in an unauthorized expenditure, and obviously it will be part of the processes the accounting officer may have failed then to exercise some of their duties to prevent that. The irregular and fruitless expenditure, we've picked up also that most of the outcomes or what causes that is what my colleague Mr. Matebula will deal with in terms of the subvention processes. If I'm not mistaken, it will be between 80 and 90% of what makes irregular and fruitless results from either not following prescripts on the supply chain side, more than it will on other functions of the financial statements. In terms of the condonation process that I will deal with later, I will explain in terms of how those are clarified. We've also provided a checklist in the next slide for the committee in terms of ensuring that what it is that the entities and the department may be looking for to ensure that they are aware of the irregularities that may arise as and when they conduct the business of the entity. Again, it's a measure of the finance division as well as in reporting, the monthly reporting on Section 40, Subsection 3 also requires that in part of the reporting in terms of to the accounting officers on a monthly basis, they need to ensure they do report in terms of unauthorized expenditure that may have incurred in terms of irregular and fruitless. So this is when, obviously, on a monthly basis, they need to use this checklist and ensure that they follow and they understand what it is that they've done. And those reports, Chair, I must add that they are reported, and the minister as well as the deputy ministers for all the departments are supposed to have a copy of, and the minister would have to sign on a monthly basis in terms of those reports and ensuring that the budget is adequately monitored as and when the departments are proceeding with their work. These are just the numbers in terms of also the treasury regulations that require, and it is mandatory for each and every entity as well as the department to pay their suppliers within 30 days, and it is the number of departments that have not, the number of invoices across spheres or various spheres of government that have not paid their invoices within 30 days, and that's the rent value. As you can see, obviously, it fluctuates from year on year, and it depends on various reasons as to why some of these may not have been paid. Most of the time, it should be, and again, it's some of the things that the Office of the Accountant General, we need to work on and clarify, because at times, there are entities that report the late payments due to disagreements or disputes. At that level, it should not form part of the 30 days. These are legitimate, if I can call it that, invoices that have nothing to do, everything has been done, the work has occurred, the invoices have been issued, there are no errors with the invoices, they're supposed to be paid within 30 days. However, if there are disputes in terms of the work may not have been delivered to the best of the expectation, either of the department or in terms of the SLAs that may have been signed, they will then not form part of this. Again, the separation was just between the provinces and national departments. Chair, also just to say what are the common reasons which obviously have, in most cases you can realize that it's also just negligence in terms of ensuring that you've misplaced or you've misfiled. There should be a centralized, we encourage departments to have an electronic system of invoices and have measures and processes and controls in place that they will be able to record and be able to track the invoices that have and have not been paid so that they can proactively put measures in place to prevent invoices that are not paid within the 30 days. The last slide, Chair, on my part is basically just focusing in terms of the responsibilities consolidated in terms of what are the executive authorities' responsibilities in terms of the PFMA. And with that, Chair, I will hand over to William Achebula on the OCPO.
Before you proceed, Machebula, there is tea there. I think we can go as long as there is no stampede. I know that people are very able to help yourselves and while the team is continuing with this presentation. Ms. Machebula?
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members and my colleagues here, thank you very much. Good morning. Mine is just to kind of explain a role of the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. The main role of the OCPO is to regulate the supply chain management across all spheres of government. We set up the rules of the game to ensure that there is efficient and transparent procurement system in the country, and of course also to ensure that the legislative framework in procurement supports government's broad socio-economic objectives. We can talk about these in many of them. Black economic environment is one, just but one of them. Industrial development, etc. Now, we draw our mandate, of course, from Section 2(1) of the Constitution, which has got the three subsections, as you can see, subsection 1, which talks to a system that is fair, equitable, transparent, cost-effective, and so on. And it enjoins the organs of state to follow that process when they procure. But that's what Section 1 does. Section 2 of 217 deals with the historically disadvantaged individuals. To say, once you have that effective system, but there must be a system, of course, that seeks to address the imbalance of the past. That's what Section 2 is all about. And then Section 3, and Subsection 3 talks to the national legislation that must inform the manner in which the disadvantaged, historical disadvantaged individuals are also taken care of in the allocation of government procurement, government allocation of contracts. So these are three subsections of 217. Okay. And now further, Section 76 of the PFMA, that's where we draw our mandate in the sense that we issue regulations and instructions and circulars and also guidelines in terms of Section 76 of the PFMA. And of course, the MFMA, this is Municipal Finance Management Act, Chapter 11, also gives powers to the Treasury to issue norms and standards. It's quite detailed, the MFMA, unlike the PFMA. And the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act, which is that legislation which is informed by Subsection 3. And that's another piece of legislation where we draw our mandate from. But I'll talk to that particular legislation later on. It talks to preferences that should be given to historically disadvantaged individuals, the black economic empowerment, et cetera, et cetera. That's what that piece of legislation said. And then further, Section 79 of the PFMA grants power to the National Treasury to approve the departures. Now, departures, that's what is excess, but departures are what we know commonly as deviations from the procurement system. So it says Treasury on good grounds may grant, may approve a departure on good grounds. And I must also hasten, Chair, to say that departures or deviations are a hallmark of any procurement system in the world. So there is no system in the world that does not have made provision for this. However, we always say this particular provision must be applied with the circumspection. So people must be careful, and it must be on exceptional grounds, not just become a norm. But at least that's provided for, and we use that particular section to approve departures from your normal procurement processes as and when we receive applications to do so. Now, further to that section, which is in the primary legislation, in the Treasury regulations themselves, which are issued in terms of Section 76 as indicated, 16A 6.4 also talks to the same thing, that where it is impractical to invite a competitive bidding process, an accounting officer now may also approve a departure or a deviation from a procurement process and record reasons for audit purposes. Then, just to curb the abuse of this particular trade regulation, 16A 6.4, we issued an instruction that all transactions that are above a million must be reported to the Auditor General within a period of 10 days to make sure that people don't abuse that particular regulation where they need to deviate from a process. And again, in as a result of the increase of the number of deviations that we picked up, and then in 2007 and 8 we issued another instruction just setting the in 2011 setting the limitations in terms of how far can institutions deviate or vary contracts and so forth. And we said that, as you can see, it was 15 million and 15% for non-construction related, and 20 million or 20% for construction related. That was in 2011. Then in 2016-17, the same instruction note came out, was issued, but the difference now in these two instruction notes, you can clearly see that they almost look the same. They're similar if you look at them. They talk to say you can deviate on images or so source. And the thresholds are also the same. The difference in this one is that in the 2016-17 one, it incorporated the entire state. Remember, Treasury regulations were applicable to national and provincial departments and constitutional institutions, which are Chapter 9 institutions, as well as Schedule 3A and 3C public entities. The 3As are your public entities that are linked to national departments, whereas the 3C public entities are linked to provincial departments. But in 2016, this was extended to cover Schedule 2s as well. Your Schedule 2 public entities are your huge, your Transnet, your ESCOM, your DENERS, your ARMS Corps, your SAA, SABC. So it was extended, whereas in the previous instruction note, it didn't cover those public entities to make sure that whenever they apply for deviations, they also follow a certain process. If, of course, it is above the set threshold, then they normally come to the provincial treasury for the provincial departments, and for national and national public entities, those applications come to Treasury and we analyze them and we approve or we don't approve. we support or we don't support some of them. As you can, it depends on your part. At least we are now able to manage some of these deviations. Now, the next slide talks to what we are currently doing. There is a public procurement bill which is currently in the cabinet system. You would recall that currently the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer operates on delegated powers. Now this bill will ensure that this office has direct powers in terms of the bill. So the bill is currently in the cabinet system for approval to Gazette for public comment. And I'm sure when the time comes, once cabinet approves, we will definitely invite all South Africans to participate in this process to make sure that at the end of the day, the procurement legislation in the country reflects the views and aspirations of South Africans. The PPPFA, there has been a lot of criticism around that particular. I think we are the first stranger to admit that, yes, it has shortcomings. So that particular bill seeks to be the overarching national procurement legislative framework in South Africa, which currently we have a number of pieces of legislation that deal with procurement issues. And of course, we have we are currently rolling out an infrastructure delivery and a procurement management framework, which seeks to make the process of delivering infrastructure at local government as well as public entities much more agile. So that is being rolled out. It has just been revised. And also, one of the reasons why there's so many deviations, as the AG would pick up, purely related to poor planning and contract management. So there is a contract management framework that we are currently revising to improve contract management at all spheres of government. And there is also a guideline that we are currently working on, which is currently being consulted with provincial treasuries, that seeks to improve the management of deviations going forward. The next slide, of course, talks to also the work of the OCPO. We issue policy instructions just to improve on the designation. This is just to support localization, as you would know. So from time to time, together with the DTI, we issue instructions to support industrial policy to make sure that is localization, proudly SA, and then all government institutions buy proudly SA goods and services. So that process is ongoing from time to time. The number of sectors, of course, and subsectors that we've already designated for local production, I think that's one area where the AG would always say, you know, you were supposed to make sure that some of the goods are procured locally, but perhaps you did not. That's one of the issues that contribute to irregular expenditure. And we also monitor the deviations as indicated. We publish procurement plans well in advance. So every 1st of April of every year, institutions are supposed to submit a procurement plan to say what are they going to procure over a period and what kind of sourcing strategy are they going to follow. Is it a competitive bid or is it a closed bid or is it a quotation and so on. That information is published on our website. And then, of course, also monitor the implementation of the procurement plan. And we also review from time to time the high-value bids just to ensure that there is compliance with norms and standards. The other work that we're doing is we are developing sourcing strategies through strategic procurement. Because you can't buy this bottle of water through the same and infrastructure through the same system. So this strategic procurement looks at what other sourcing strategies can we apply as government. In fact, we've also effected same in the procurement bill. We can talk about the bill, but not now. And also where it is it makes sense to do so. We facilitate what we call transversal term contracts. These are contracts which are cross-cutting. For instance, if you take fuel, it would make sense for every government department to go out and buy fuel. You only have 6 oil companies in the country. So what we do, we consolidate volume and we issue one tender centrally within Treasury, and then everybody else buys from that particular contract to make sure that we derive economic benefits out of economies of scale. So this is what transversal contracts are there for, where it makes sense to do so. Also taking account of local economic development priorities, because some provinces are not the same, to avoid over-concentration. Rural provinces, urban provinces, just to make sure that we spread the kind of economic opportunities. And also, we have a system of automating the system, the procurement system. Currently, we have what we call a central supply base, a database. So in the past, every department would have to set up its own database of suppliers and so on. But currently, there is one system centrally. And then those that want to do business in the state, they don't have to register in each and every institution in government. The self-registration online, they register, and that information becomes available countrywide. So this is part of our effort, but we'll continue to make sure. And also, the publication of tenders. Tenders are uploaded electronically. So, but we do hear instances where people are still selling tenders, but our position has always been tenders must be free. They're uploaded. People can upload a tender, print them themselves wherever they are, and then complete and submit electronically as well as hard copies. So that these are some of the efficiencies that we are working on currently, or the ones that are existing. So, Chair, at least for now, let me stop here. Thank you very much.
So, I'll hand back to the chairs and the committee. I think we managed to be exactly within our time frame, and I'm certainly hoping there's an indication of how Treasury will comply with the rules of the committee going forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. I think we'll take questions and comments from the honourable members, but just to say, my co-chairs are also allowed to go ahead. can you take questions and and I'll request that honourable members just say who they are, so that they can know who they're answering. But again, for them to familiarise themselves with us, because they're still going to see a lot of us. I can assure you of that.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mervyn Dutt. I am the work of SCOPA. Ponyami, remember Ponyami. So, I raised the issue yesterday when he was there, the anti-corruption task team was there, raised the issue about the GMFA situation. But afterwards I realized, I think I raised it with the wrong people, because they are just there to enforce our laws, because they were looking, they are not finance people, they are state law enforcement agencies. As I said yesterday, I do not have a problem with the PMFA insofar as the transparency, the accountability, those things are very good, I support it. My concern was the issue of fairness. You put it very nicely, fairness. Yes, I do not mention the word fairness, but actually the fairness of the system. I think it's a very good system in a first world country, but in an unequal society like South Africa, the system is definitely going to exclude the majority of people which were previously excluded from the economy. And that is my concern I have with the system. And that's why even at our 54th conference, we raised this issue and we stated it at the conference because I'm opposed to the resolution. But I'm very happy that your explanation said that there's a bill now and there'll be public participation so we can address these shortcomings, the shortcomings. Because that leads actually, that fairness and that exclusion where that's very good. The one part is good, but on the other end, the effect of it is actually excluding our people. And that actually leads to corruption. That leads to corruption because it's impossible for our people to get in. Our people have to participate in the economy. But with that legislative of legislation, it's impossible. Then they'll try and find other means of participating. And I said, also as I raised it, there's a structure of our economy. We have to change the structure of the economy. To allow our people to participate in the economy, because you don't have to necessarily have to rotate towards politics and political parties to actually get into the economy. But currently, the way the economy is structured, that's why people, when you see them going to politics, to get into this economy. It shouldn't be like that. To change it, where people don't have to participate in politics in the country, which is a normal citizen, but who can have access to participate in this economy. And we must change the system so that we can ensure that our people participate. We must make the majority of our people participate in the economy. Because our people are getting reckless out there. The young is getting reckless. They're getting more and more educated. The educated people, I know young African electrical engineers that are sitting at the age of 35 years old, they're still youth. They are electrical engineers that are doing their PhD. They are consulting engineers. And they simply cannot get into the system. They can't get in. These are not gender criteria, these are young professionals. So we must create an enabling environment in this new piece of principle where we can pull people into participating in the economy. That's what I want to see. But we can keep the other systems in play to check the balance, accountability, the transparency. But don't make it so difficult for our people to participate. The system is very, very difficult for them to get in. But I'm happy that this piece of legislation, as I said to the anti-corruption council, I said we certainly draft legislation in court rooms and we bring in professors, experts from universities and from all over the world to draft legislation in the courtroom, but we have not gone through the method to confine final problem. What is it really? How they can participate? And I'm happy that the public hearings, people can, and you'll have a lot of responses. Those public hearings will be packed. We'll have people, young black professionals come in and make their input and will be very, very good at their participation. I'm very glad about this. Thank you.
Thank you,
Shepherd,
and thanks to all National Treasury officials for the presentation. And in particular, Shepherd, my question is just one, and in your conclusion, you somehow responded to the question that has been welling in my head. And it is the issue related to, with all this in place, why do we still have this problem of a selective allocation of contracts in the public space, when there is the central database. And I would want to know, because especially if you look at the level of provinces and municipalities and other agencies of government, why do we seem to have this particular problem? And what is it that can still be done to tighten the loopholes? Because for me, I thought the CSD process is really the easy way of making it possible for even the so-called unknown, because people used to believe you have to be known by somebody in government for you to be able to qualify. And also for the rotation. And I don't know. I've met several people who have always said, In the local language, they give people, they take people halfway. in terms of doing contracts and entering. They actually say, some of them say, they would be given these small things that you've got a profit of about 1,000, just to make it possible that it is being seen that you are being considered. And I think that is where we have a problem, that we need to tighten those particular loopholes so that everybody who is trying to his hand in business should actually get an opportunity. In many countries in the world, Jefferson, there's indication that small business is actually a job creator. But if we have our people who are trying to enter these small business areas where they can employ five or less on this number of people, and they are unable to enter in this space, then that's why you would have the massive numbers of people much more on our streets on a daily basis. And that's where you will have your people like you was talking about, your contractors, people with the skill. I'll make an example to you. There was a gentleman that I called at last minute just for a plumbing issue. He did a good work. And I looked at the type of work that others who do work for government are doing, which is shoddy. And I asked him, but with this good abilities, why are you not doing work for government? And he said, no, ma'am, we will never get that space. We will never enter. If you know the job, that's who is, he actually said it. If you know the job, you are the one that is not needed, because you will do a good quality job, and then the one who's doing shoddy work knows he's going to be called back and forth and keep on getting money that way. And I don't think it is correct for us to allow for that to happen. The other thing is the issue of the unpaid 30 days this thing, the invoices. I don't know, this has been said for many years, that people must be paid, I mean businesses must be paid within 30 days. If you look at the amounts that you have tabulated here, it's a lot of money that government institutions and government departments are owing small businesses. We're actually pushing companies down and under. And then we've got this problem of the economy is not growing, there's no jobs that are being created, whilst we're sitting and owing. Equally so, there's another element, I don't know whether it falls within your space, of a government institutions owing municipalities for rates and services. I think that is also another contributing factor to the challenges that we have in local government. So I would believe that there is ways in which we can help. But thank you very much for the presentation. It is an opener and it helps us to understand what your responsibilities are. Just last point, Jefferson. The investigations that the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer does, where do they end? How do they fit into the other investigations by Public Protector and the SIU and all those others? Do they just end up in the air because they would be said that the OCPO, no, let me leave the acronym, the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer is dealing with. Thank you very much.
That was the Honorable Speaker from SCOA. Honorable Kaito.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Tolisi Lekaiso from SCOA. Chairperson, there are these questions that comes into my mind every time, you know, the presentation or work to be put in front of this committee by the treasurer. But sometimes I say, hey, must I ask this question or wait a bit? But then you tell me when this question is out of order. Because you know, sometimes outside there, when we interact with our people, when we talk about treasure, with the poor working class, they have always expectations to hear that we are going to be rescued when we are in trouble. In terms of jobs and poverty. Now, there is a there is national development policy, the NDP policy, and there are statements, serious statements that the president has committed to do in the country. From the Olehota, in terms of, you know, dealing with the issue of unemployment, high level of unemployment in the country. So that is a question that I speak sometimes when you come here. Must I ask this question? Must I ask Treasury this? When are you going to align your policy or your systems to what the president is saying when it comes to poverty? Is this thing up, does this thing appear somewhere in your presentation sometimes, you know, but it's good. We have written good English here, a nice presentation. Our books are glamorous, you know. But when I go outside there as an MP, the people want to know, hey, when are you going to assist us with employment? So what answer should I give? And say, no. We have done things differently because this phenomenon has reached alarming proportions in the country of unemployment, especially by the young people. Now, the first person or institution that I'm looking for as a member of parliament is to say perhaps our treasurer will be able to assist us. How does it talk to the Hota statement as pronounced by the president? How does the treasury is now prepared to align, because to align it means now the policy will be speaking directly to the challenges that the country is facing, especially the people of the country is facing. So those are the things that I sometimes, should I ask it or should I wait? But as you know, I must ask you now. Yes, we know there is now a reconfiguration of the department. Probably this will be covered when there's the pronouncement in terms of medium term expenditure framework to take care of this reconfigured arrangement. But my primary question is, how far is the Treasury, you know, moving in terms of realigning to look into this? Because the outcry there of poverty and unemployment is so serious that we cannot ignore it. We must say, yes, we have begun the process to realign our Treasury to talk to that process. Otherwise, we will just be making a nice presentation and telling the same story that now we are operating like this and this and this. But the reality is that the poor people outside, they are waiting for us to give a proper, you know, intervention. What is this strategic intervention that is incorporated in your policy that you are intending to do? Is there any intention? Thank you very much.
Honorable.
Thank you very much. No, I think my concern was that maybe I'll be flying too low, but I think the comrade that spoke before me actually made my life easy, because the presentation, which I welcomed from Treasury, was at very high level, and to a certain degree, when you refer to institutions that you give support, you will end up at provincial level, and you do not go below that. So the questions that I have, I think, will be mainly around the lower sphere, which is the local government sphere. And the first one is on the issue of local government borrowing when they go into the debt market in order to augment their capex budget. The provincial treasury as well as national treasury will in most instances, actually in all of them, make comments in terms of the view they have on their particular intention to go into the market. Now the question that I have is, how do you interlink the borrowing and the rolling over of grants and returning of some grants back to Treasury. Because my concern is that if you can't spend the budget that you have and you end up rolling back, why then do you go to the tax market and expose taxpayers and residents to borrowing costs? Because my view is that if you have 10, you only spend 4, why then go out and borrow 2 so that you have 12? So that will be the first question. And the second one is just a clarity seeking question. On instruction notes, are we speaking of what normally would refer to as circulars from National Treasury? And if the answer is correct, how do we as National Treasury ensure that the institutions that these instructions are given do comply with these notes? And the reason I'm asking is that if these notes apply to local government, the area in which I come from, before coming here, it is the first time that I see amounts attached to the particular instructions. We know the three requirements: emergency, sole provider, or livestock, or animals, something like that. But there were never amounts. And I can tell you now, sitting here, I know that these amounts here are exceeded on a continuous basis by local state of government. So are we in a position to monitor that the instructions that are given are complied with? And when there's no compliance, how then do we ensure that implementation of this particular instruction notes is actually expedited? The last one doesn't speak to the presentation, but somehow to the mandate of National Treasury in building a capable state. What is the view of National Treasury on the sovereign debt and how we are servicing it? Is our servicing only focusing on the interest part, or are we also taking the principal debt? And given our stagnant economy now, where we are, do we think that we make a meaningful dent to our debt and at the same time try to achieve all these key priorities that were set by the President and Cabinet to ensure that our economy does indeed grow? Because I asked a question the other day to the DM to say that when you see this what we call bailout of ESCOM in particular, we do not speak about the challenges that is being raised by the media and other industry specialists of plants that might not necessarily be able to work after they are completed because either the plans were wrong or the designs were faulty. The story, I'm sure you know the story of the plants that were building like Midupi and Kufi. And I came across an article in one of the newspapers a few days back that we might need to raise another $80 billion in order to comply with the World Bank conditions for ESCOM infrastructure bills. Now that question, that article speaks directly to my question, that as and when we plan, are we able to incorporate the possibility that we have to start the work that is shoddy from scratch? And when we do that, are we going to come back to the fifth cut, or are we going to pursue those that have given us policy plans and have showed it well? So that's something that I just need clarity on in terms of what is the approach as far as the one is concerned. So thank you very much, Chair.
That was the Honourable Matap from Standing Committee on Appropriation. Honourable Sarupin.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Ashwal Sarupin. I'm a member of the Appropriations Committee. I think I've been partially covered by my colleague here. So just augment his questions around the guidelines and circulars issued, particularly in terms of the MFMAs. Do they actually have any teeth? I remember many, many years ago when I was in local government and Circular 58 came out, and Circular 58 said, tell municipalities to stop giving, as part of overseas travel, unlimited subsistence allowances, amongst other things. And and so on, and tell them to comply in terms of their tools of trade to councils and so on, of what the committee that deals with that, the remuneration committee that deals with tools of trade are, don't deviate from those allowances and so on. But it didn't have any teeth. It didn't stop the municipality I was in from continuing doing whatever it was doing anyway. They said these are just guidelines, and that's how they treated it at local government. So what teeth do they have, and how do you ensure that MFMA circulars are actually enforced? Because for the, by and large, they get issued and then just get ignored by the people who receive them. And then secondly, on the 30-day payment to suppliers that you listed, a lot of this ends up then, when it doesn't get paid, you end up with a whole lot of accruals. And accruals accrue and accrue and accrue over years, over years, over years. And you open an annual report, and then you'll find that Gauteng Department of Health has more accruals than its annual budget can cater for. What is actually going on in terms of accrual management from the way Treasury deals with government departments and entities on accruals, and how they how are you ensuring that when budgeting planning is done, and maybe I should save this question for later, but maybe we can deal with it now, when budgeting planning is done, that they actually plan to pay down accruals, because there seems to be get departments that have no grip in their accruals, and as a result, suppliers who hardly ever or never get paid as a result of the long-term consequence. And then lastly, bailout money given to SOEs. How do you monitor what this is spent on? Do you attach conditions to it? We've seen over the last 10 years in particular, lots of bailouts to state-owned enterprises. And this is taxpayer money. So Eskom, for example, charges people for electricity. And so we all pay for electricity in this room and so on. But then we pay taxes, and the taxes also then end up paying for electricity. We're paying double. So there's a burden on Treasury when you hand over money to SOEs for services we're paying for elsewhere to SOEs as well, to make sure that when you give taxpayer money to them, that is actually spent effectively and efficiently and on specific functions. And I'd like to get an idea of what's going on there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. One of my questions just has been asked. On the when looking to the notice written heading on the late payments to service providers, which has changed a bit friendly language, rather than, because the end result of such late payments is accruals in any event. So the way it's presented to us, it might present itself as a very light way of looking into these late payments. So it might push out that it's dealt with a different thing. My chair here from Scopa reminded us yesterday to say all those who are coming to present are here on a friendly meeting. It's a friendly meeting. And the question that I would ask if it was not a friendly meeting. So since it is a friendly meeting, it then deals with matters of saying you are coming to us or to expose us to say these are the things that you're going to attend or you're attending to. One of those, you are saying there's this a central supply database. But at the same time, you see there are some consequences that are reliant on an as if we're still without this kind of an operation. Suppliers still remaining unpaid because invoices are not known, they might be somewhere else and so forth. And that itself is saying it might be that we have got time now that this kind of an operation has been increased. Some assessments need to be done to ensure that some of the things that are happening, which were happening, cannot happen, or are happening in a very limited nature. A last point which I wanted to make reference to is this point which has been highlighted on procurement deviations. The guidelines which are coming out, which can be in a similar way, that once you say guidelines, whatever notice you issue, that is not enforceable, it's a guideline. You see, in a way, why do you choose to put things which bedevil expenditure or non-expenditure, or which at times lead to corruption, one way or another? Because you can only need to deviation, a number of them would give a different result if you dig deeper into them, one way or the other. So why are you still issuing guidelines, you see, than coming up with some kind of a firm notice on such aspects, which are very critical in terms of the output. One of those explanations, you see, it was looking at the time when variations are cropping up towards the end of the financial year, quite a lot of those, or towards the end of the year, so there will be somewhat quite a lot of observations around that, and there will be known culprits which are somewhat linked to such kind of occurrences. So why that choice and the limitation as well to limit yourself into consulting services, and you don't consult local governments on your exposition here, that you are consulting provinces on these for them before they come alive. And there's a lot of expenditure which goes to local governments, and therefore it might be good that they must be included in that consulting frame, so that even them they are somewhat have some kind of knowledge of these kinds of. But my query is on a very soft approach going forward. So I reserve some of other things that I would say on another meeting, which might be termed differently.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks a lot, Chair. Look, colleagues, my traveler will know that we've had this headache for a long length of time. And they were triggered, you recall, by Transport, because they've become a norm and not an exception. And so the challenge is, whilst you may issue all these instructions or informal guidelines as a means of checks and balance, my question is, what systems are you building in place in Treasury to facilitate a process which make sure that these deviations and exceptions don't become involved? Because you'll recall that in the many applications that the previous worker received, you would cite all sorts of concerns about the request. 9, 10 of them, and you come to bullet 11 and then you approve it. So the approval and the rationale just was inconsistent. And you recall that we had issues the longest of time. So whilst they may be headway in making sure that there's compliance with your stakeholders, sister departments and so on, my issue is about internal control about this particular matter in Treasury, to make sure that there is not a runaway train of approvals in the manner in which it happens. Because I think the fact that you cite contract management as a fundamental shortcoming insofar as while many people resort to this, we should not be correcting those shortcomings on contract management with a free reign for deviation and extension. So if you can just take us through that particular aspect. Two, the 30 days. This is an old headache. And the question becomes, what recourse do the service providers have in the face of the very stubborn department? Because it's all good and well to tabulate that, look, well, this department always got my invoices of 20 million, da-da-da-da-da, but the small businesses whom the country is relying on as the jobs driver, economic growth, economic development, are actually killed by the fact that they are not paid. So what recourse is there? And to make sure that there's compliance. And for, because the other thing is that these invoices are gathering interest. And then that becomes wasteful expenditure. Because it should not have happened to begin with. So we are settled with a problem that we know, which we're talking to departments and so on, but it does not seem to, the conveyor belt seems to get stuck at that point. And then my worry is small businesses. Because I made the point to auditors last week that the invoices that are paid on time would be the first ones I would query about cleaning invoices. Or if one investigation was done. Because most likely, the ones who agree to pay a kickback and a bribe fast track their processing of their invoice. And the small business that can't, because well, small business is just no money, because you're not prepared to pay, you're not going to facilitate your invoice. So we can look at what could be the obvious technical, noble reasons to say, well, there's a shortcoming, competence, and so on. But we're also dealing with the fundamental concern of corruption. And how much of these invoices really are subject, how many of them are subjected to what I can call bullying by the powers that be. And so I think we really need to drill in deeper into why these invoices can scratch beyond the surface. Because, these small businesses are being taken from pillar to post, rings are being run around and they're being frustrated. Process out of business, and the things we spoke about trying to open up the space, localization and so on, is frustrated by the fact that you're creating a very low-lying ceiling for these businesses. Their first point of business is frustrated by the fact that there's this challenge, and of course sustainability becomes a problem. So I would imagine that in part of the auditing that you do, let's look at the ones who are being paid and ask ourselves, why is it easy for them to get paid and difficult for others to get paid? If we are, I mean, I look at the 1 year here, 2017, 2018, there was an escalation of slide, what are we speaking about? Slide 18. I mean, invoices in 2017-18 that were older than 30 days and not paid, 14,746 up from 5,268. Surely that on its own should, you know, sound the alarm bell that there's something in this. So if you can just, I mean, I harp on it because I really think that it does a huge disservice to small businesses. Finally, Chair, there's the issue of the new mandate, extended mandate for the AG, insofar as material irregularities are concerned. I just want to get Treasury's views about that and how they see it as an enabler, if it is, and where they identify it as a challenge, so that we can understand it holistically. We had the AG yesterday, and he took time to fully take us through, what is going on, and that was, you know, very welcome on our part. But it's always good to look at these things from the different vantage points, also of the the relevant stakeholders in the space, just how you view that particular. And I know that someone else speaks about a friendly meeting, and this is not your hearing, but I think because the chair of position is raised in the chair of sport, this issue of action, if you can convey to your legislative authority and your authority officer, we can't have a generation so style like of administration, particularly a treasurer. Because it's common cause that acting does not breed stability. There's a sort of a hambagashi approach because maybe you may be aspiring to the position. You don't have rock the boat. This is not true. But I'm saying as a principle, I'm sure you understand it better. So if you can just convey that for us, that we, particularly in strategic positions that you occupy, I've never told you, I've been asking for a very long time. If you can let be raised and it can be brought to a logical conclusion so that when you arrive next time you can actually arrive at people with accountability is entrenched in people are in full time positions. Acting does create that particular, so it's not a criticism of you, this is not your decision to take, but I request that you convey it. We will also from us, but I think as a point of departure, if we want to inspire confidence in the other departments, we need treasury to walk the talk of what we mean about ability, particularly in the financial management.
Yes. Honourable Tihare, just dying, one thing that she wants to say, please do.
Thank you very much for presenting my apologies that I went outside. I must also emphasize the issue of the officials here coming to this committee being on an acting position. We really don't want to hear the chairperson again. I'm sure next time when they come, they'll be coming with their real position, especially that they put the women to act in this month. We really don't want to see that and hear that again. Well, because I am running out of time, I will only talk on this slide number 19, whereby they presented on the common residence rate and on non-payment of invoices. Yeah, I hear the reasons why this will normally happen. But when we were doing oversight on our parliament, truly speaking, people were not receiving their payments. And it will escalate up until 3 years. We went to housing on the issue of human settlement. There were companies which waited for payment and they were forever waiting. Even yesterday, I was talking to one other guy from Polokwane. He's still waiting for his payment and he did everything. So I don't know whether you're responsible to really assist to these people who are doing the work by the issue of acting, do not react. Thank you.
Thank you so much, honorable member. This was just a flavor of what is we can expect from Treasure. I'm not going to go through the number of questions. I have a whole group of questions. This committee is obviously very much interested in what you are doing, and in particular, SCOA, you appropriate money to government to be used. And let me just tell you this one: what comes from the committee from SCOA, etc. We're still going to have a longer session with you. We are saying as members of parliament that we don't want to be security guards of the budget now, right? And then we still go and so on. Take that one because we are going to be following very, very, very strongly. This year, 2019-2020, a budget of about 1.4 trillion rand. Coming year, 1.5 trillion rand. MTF, about 4.65 trillion rand. and all what you come here and sit and so forth, but at the end of the day, the certain things that you want the budget to do are not happening. So one of the things, one of the budget that we are talking about, the money that we are collectively responsible for, is the tool that we have to transform the economy of this country, right? But when you look at all the indicators that are going different directions, you look at inequality, what's happening, inequality, we're approaching 1.7, so you use the Gini coefficient, right? You look at unemployment rates, they are high up there. So we are still going to invite you, and as you can see, that the questions that I remember are up to, they cut across national treasury, not just you. But they will just give you a flavor of what to expect as you continue interacting. I definitely reserve my points and questions. What I remember is that when Matebula started acting, I had three responsibilities. He's been acting as the CEO, and I'm afraid Mrs. Becker, the same thing will happen. I'll find myself somewhere as you speak the acting, so I think we'll raise that with the political office and with the teachers when we meet, and that it's very important that we increase stability when it comes to this thing. As one of the gamers say, when you are acting, general, there are things that you may want to raise with the teacher, but they are still dependent on him whether you are going to be confirmed or not. So it definitely creates instability. That's my little bit of an input. Please just try to run through the questions, and other members will also understand that you may not be able to cover them all, because we should also be breaking. But as you said, this is just the first one.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much to the committee for these constructive questions. I certainly do agree it's indicative of the relationship of vigorous engagement I'm sure we're going to have. I just wanted to address three matters, if I can, in terms of the context, and then I'll hand over to my colleagues to address the specific questions. I wanted to indicate just as we go forward, and I'm sure we will apply this as a principle in this committee and the other committees that Treasury goes to. The work that Treasury does, as you know, whilst it's wide-ranging, it's very specific in its technical competencies. So I've just indicated of those programs, we do everything from, as you know, tax matters, to procurement matters, to assets and liabilities and SOC matters. So it is important that when a question gets asked by the committee, if those technical people are not in the delegation, we commit either to bring them to the committee to answer the question, or we will answer the question in writing, rather than give the committee a vague response that won't be technically astute and substantive. So if where we've been asked questions like that, I'll indicate them and then we can come back to the committee on those matters. Also, I do agree the Chair has in fact already put forward something that I'd like to echo, and that is around the matters of the transformation of the control measures and apparatus of the economy and the contribution that National Treasury is making towards that transformation, which is a national imperative and a priority for National Treasury. Part of that contribution is located in the OCPO's office, in the initiative that they do, and I'm sure that Willie will talk to that in terms of the procurement process. But there's other work that we do in other divisions, in tax, in Program 8 as well. So I am suggesting that we can return to the committee as the Chair has already proposed, and we speak on that matter. And if we can also attach that, because transformation and addressing inequality, and by inequality, we need to address the issues of unemployment. If we can address those two matters in a session, So I think that is not, they are such important matters for the country and in terms of treasury and our priorities that they deserve a session of their own. And we will attach them to speaking to the committee about the work that we're doing around growth. Because obviously for treasury, a big part of addressing inequality and poverty and by extension unemployment is around what treasury is doing around growth and stimulating growth in the economy. So if the committee would agree, we'll come and talk about those three things together. Transformation of the economy, the work that we're doing in terms of poverty alleviation and growth. Also, I'd like to say on the issues around the questions that we've got around the borrowing and the capex budget, the questions around sovereign debt, and the questions around bailouts. Can we please come back to the committee on that? The reason being, bailouts is a better spoken to by assets and liabilities. That's their technical competency. And the question around grants and borrowings is IGR, their responsibility. So I am not going to waste the valuable time of the committee by giving you a vague response. If I may please come back on those two, either the committee, so we can do it in writing, or if you want, at your next sitting, we'll come back with IGR and assets and liabilities.
Can I suggest that on the issues that will come back in writing, that you want to come back on that you send those through in writing, and then say next week Wednesday, those are received, and then the committee can apply their minds once they've received the information and processed it, so that they can have an informed discussion on the basis of that. I'm sure the chair can be agreeable to it. So if we can get those written responses to all issues next week Wednesday, and the committee is received to them, then we schedule the meeting once we receive that.
Thank you very much, Chair. So having dealt with those matters, I'm going to hand over to the acting, and on the matter of acting, before I hand over. We certainly note the concerns that have been voiced by the joint committees, and we recognise the challenges of this long overdue process and the effect and impact this has on the stability of the institution. And I will certainly take this back to the executive authority where this matter currently lies. On that matter, I hand over to the acting Accountant General to answer all questions.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks, committee members, honourable committee members. In responding, so I will just give a consolidated answer on specific themes that came out. And as my colleague said, Laura, that we will, where required, provide a detailed response. I must say, Chair, part of obviously what would make me focus more on PFMA as still consider myself the CFO of the Treasury, it's because obviously we operate under the TFMA, and maybe I may have erred in not over-emphasizing the role that Treasury plays on the municipal finance space, which is obviously quite a critical role. To mention the few, Chair, and again, I would where required, avail myself and the team that specializes in the MFMA, as there is quite a robust program that we have as the Treasury programs, rather, that we have as the Treasury. Number one. Number two, we engage quite a lot, the our technical committees, to an extent on some officials on a weekly basis with the Office of the Auditor General in ensuring that we are at par, as well as we keep each other abreast with the developments in the municipal finance space. Part of the key programs that the Treasury is currently engaged on is the Municipal Finance Improvement Program. That looks at the outcry that is happening, as the honourable members have raised, with regards to transgressions and with regards to non-payments, with regards to poor performance in certain municipalities. There are those programs which internally are also in conjunction or in partnership with the IGR, which is the integrated intergov department we're working with. There are certain grants that are also available in ensuring that the work of the municipality is taken and service deliveries are provided, including from the OHE side. As I've said, the MFIP program deals with, obviously, the finance, municipal finance improvement. It is under the Office of the Accountant General, as well as also the audit outcome from the MFMA, in ensuring that the MFMA is given the attention that it deserves. Recently, the office, through the minister, we issued a gazette on the cost containment measures on the municipality side. As you would understand, on the PPMA side, we issued a few years back. This is also our intervention on ensuring that some of the questions with the enforcement of certain circulars that were raised, where we realized that they were not being applied and adhered to. With that, obviously, linking the challenges, and again, it's something that is Treasury, there's a process in place in terms of amending, one, the Treasury regulations that we aim that by November 2019 it will be published currently. It has been finalized and it's supposed to be circulated for public comment as a final draft for it will be published for 90 days so that there is a public finance, public comment. So with that, obviously, we're trying to ensure all the circulars that have since have been issued have been incorporated into those changes so that they are enforceable in terms of compliance and in terms of legislation. As indeed, circulars become a guide and they become they are not as, I would say, as powerful, in lack of a better word, in comparison to instruction notes, for example. So hence, because of all those reasons, we make sure that we are updating also our pieces of legislation. With regards also to just touching on the borrowing side, Laura is quite right in terms of the discussions and the details will be the IGR from the Office of the Accountant General. The approvals, or the noting rather, because we do not approve, and the legislation does not require us to approve. However, it requires us to note and provide technical advice and assistance and analysis in looking at the facts and the cases that are brought to us prior the municipality's borrowing. So we do look at that as well. And that's where, obviously, we consult through also the IGR, who will be key and instrumental in providing the advice from the operations side. Chair, in terms of the 30 days invoice, and indeed it is becoming a concern because it seems the system in which we are operating under as government is obviously there's something that needs to be worked on, and I'm quite confident that with the new administration as well as the new changes that are happening, it will also assist in the process of us as the officials in ensuring that we enforce through the mandates that are given to the Treasury, we enforce the compliance with this. The 30 days, as much as we have the report in terms of the numbers, the Office of the OCPO is also tasked with ensuring that it does rise to each and every entity, and Bab Matibula will obviously take us through in detail in terms of the processes involved. And through the PAA, the Public Audit Act, Chair, as you said, you wanted us to touch on that in terms of our views. It's part of those things in terms of if there are consequence management processes that are not being adhered to and followed. So we really hope that the new process will also strengthen the process in ensuring that indeed departments do pay within 30 days. As has been noted and is quite correct, it has an impact on many other functions in terms of the financial statements, in terms of the accruals, which my public finance official colleagues will obviously touch on in terms of the processes that they go through in granting the budgets, balancing that with the rollovers, which as the CFO, former CFO of the Treasury, I would understand the processes in terms of they do not grant rollovers simply because they are managing in terms of poor planning and implementation of budgets by departments. So with that, Chair, I'm saying in terms of our views, we've engaged quite a lot on an ongoing basis, and we still do, because as you may have been aware, that part of the PAA, the Public Audit Act, and the amendments specifically, in terms of the enforcement of certain clauses, there needs to be concurrence with the Treasury. There needs to be an agreement, for example, in terms of what is the criteria in terms of which municipalities or entities rather that will be considered unable to pay, for example, in terms of the audit fees, and thus end up with unauthorized expenditure of certain cases. So we're quite involved in that. In our view as the Treasury, we support, obviously, the implementation and ensuring that there is enforcement in the public service, and there is, obviously, adherence to the terms, to the rules and Treasury regulations and the DFMA that have been given. And again, obviously, we will continuously support the initiatives, obviously, going through all the technical complexities of the amendment of the Act, supporting it also with a view of it's not a, as they may have shared obviously with you, that it's not a issue today, a material irregularity and a certificate tomorrow. It's quite a robust, quite a long process actually. We foresee it on average probably taking no less than 18 months just to issue one, simply because we also support that the accounting officers as well as the entities are given a fair chance to present their cases, and ensuring that if it is indeed material and it is irregular, how is it dealt with? And just to overemphasize on the point that the material irregularity does not mean the minute you have an irregular expenditure, it amounts to material irregularities, because those will obviously technically mean different things. We are quite involved in it as the Treasury. As you will understand that whatever the Auditor General audits would have come from the Office of the Accountant General through the precepts that are there. I believe that from the Office of the Accountant General, most of the issues have been covered. Where they have not, we will obviously provide a written comment where required. Thank you.
Thank you again, Honorable Chairs and members. I'm just going to limit myself to at least three issues. The first one, the issue around payment or non-payment of suppliers. This is, in terms of law, a financial misconduct. This is provided for in the Treasury regulations, and this is also provided for in the MFMA, Municipal Finance Management Office. Financial misconduct. From our side as the National Treasury, we issued not one instruction around this particular issue, sensitizing accounting officers to do what they're supposed to do. The financial misconduct, and it's a serious issue. That's the first thing. The second part that I wanted to talk to is around the instructions and circulars that we spoke to. The reason why we have the bill in the first place, that public procurement bill, part of the reason is to consolidate all these many instructions which institutions may not be in a position to implement into a single regulatory framework. Currently, instructions and circulars, their purpose is to augment where there is a gap in law. But like when you build a house and you keep on, you know, adding a room, add a room there, add a room, at the end of the day, you even lose the original structure of the house. So this is what our legislation is. We issue so many instructions. In fact, the entire system is flocked with instructions. As a result, you can't comply with the thing. And then some of them are conflicting in nature, etc., etc. So the review of this whole process, so you eliminate instructions, you put whatever you have in a single overarching national legislation. That's the purpose of that bill. The other purpose of the bill, of course, is it talks to issues of transformation, I mean, which are quite key, other than just other issues. Issues of transformation, which are quite critical, as you would know, that we've got many pieces of legislation that try to deal with issues of transformation. The DE Act, the Preferential Procurement Act, many, many other pieces of legislation. But at least there is a chapter in that bill that will deal with that particular issue. It also grants the provinces some kind of flexibility to to issue their own, just, you know, precise systems or transformation systems, but within the ambit of the national framework, you know, given the dynamics of different provinces. That's what it does. And lastly, Chair, I think the issue around deviations, and I agree that it could be the choice of words, whether we say it's a framework, whether we say a guideline. I guess that's the reason why we are currently consulting with our other colleagues, and we take the point that we may have to also extend consultation to the likes of SALGA and local government to ensure that at the end of the day, that framework reflects the inputs by everybody in the country. Now, internally, Chair, around why we want to have the framework, part of the reason is that deviations cannot only be a responsibility of the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. There are other equally important divisions within the Treasury, the Budget Office, because it involves budget, the Public Finance Office, the Office of the Accountant General, assets and liabilities which are managing state-owned entities. Now, the idea is to have at least a committee to look at all these things, rather than having OCDO alone looking. You have this committee, and then you've got a multiplicity of ideas. So when Transnet submits an application to DVA or PRAS or ESCOM, there's a collective that looks at that, and then that particular committee would then make a recommendation whether you approve or you don't approve a particular deviation. That's the essence of that particular framework. As we go, hence we just need to bring in everybody else. On CSD, yes, the central supply database, firstly, is not a gatekeeper. So in other words, it's not that if you are not registered on CSD, then you can't do business with the state. That's not the purpose. This is a database. All it says for quotations where people have to do quotations, then you go to the CSD and look at those that are registered on CSD. But for your open competitive bids above a certain threshold, obviously you issue open competitive bids. And there may be other suppliers who may not necessarily be registered at the time when you issue a tender, but they are eligible to participate in that process. What we say is that at least once you've done that process and you've selected a preferred supplier, a service provider, then that service provider, of course, must comply, and then they must register and comply with everything else that goes with the central supply database. But it's not a gatekeeper. It's not to say that if you are not on that list, you can't do business with government. The database, you do business, but for quotations, you go to that database, and then, of course, we encourage rotation of suppliers to ensure that at least you spread the economic opportunities to the broader society than repeating the same one and the same kind of service providers. I think let me end here for now. The other issues we'll deal with. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you so much. Before I hand over to the back to the committee, I just want to say, in terms of the deviations and that system, in part it was a response to this committee and the discussions we had around Transnet and how Treasury's treatment of that has resulted in what is effectively an overhaul of the internal management around deviations, and it's a good example of how these processes not only enhance and strengthen government processes, but Treasury's processes as well. So I thought that was very important to put forward. And the second issue I just want to end on is the fact that consultation around the procurement bill is going to be critical. And so we would certainly be looking at these committees to assist us to ensure that our reach on that consultation It's one of the most important. It's not the only piece of legislation we'll put forward. As you know, we'll be putting forward several pieces of legislation this year. It is going to be a busy legislative year for Treasury. But this is one of the critical pieces of legislation. And we believe that it is through this public consultation process that this piece of legislation will not only be strengthened, but gain traction and be able to address some of these critical issues that we've long been raised. So we will certainly not only be looking to this, these committees to assist us with the substantive part of this bill, but to help us make sure that our public process is as robust as it can be. On that note, I'd like to hand back over to the chair.
Thank you very much, Treasury colleagues. Are we good? To the chair, thank you very much. Treasury, thank you. We shall meet in not friendly meeting. But we really appreciate you taking the time to be here. We hope that we will meet soon. You spoke about municipalities. We will be relying on National Treasury as COPA in the coming weeks as we deal with the 13 municipalities that have been cited by AG, which have received the scandal at its findings for a period of 3 to 5 years or more. And so the issue that has been raised is very relevant in the discussion that we'll be having there as well. And I'm sure that moving forward after our oversight as COPA to meeting with the ESCOM board next week, on the issues that we want to raise with National Treasury as well. So from our side, I'm sure all the committees have got an open door policy, and as and when you will be available, and as and when you are required, we will be available. So on that note, thank you very much, and of course the responses can be sent to the various committee secretariats by next week, Wednesday, and that should be very good. This session ends. Mama Zibula will come and chair now the next session starting at 20 past 11 with the SIU. So we will take a 13-minute break and then promptly at 20 past 11 SIU. So we've got 10 minutes or so to get yourself ready. Colleagues, thank you very much.
Congratulations.